It's easy to see they're not used to having anything, the way they brag about everything. 'Tis a real low-class mind that will call out the door and tell the world what they're having for the supper. She says 'tis their way of getting a rise out of us because Dad is a foreigner from the north, and he won't have anything to do with them. Dad says, all that food comes from English money, and no luck will come to those who took it. But what could you expect from Limerick anyway? People who profit from Hitler's war, people who will work and fight for the English. He says he'll never go over there and help England win a war. Mam says, no, you'll stay here where there's no work and hardly a lump of coal to boil water for the tea. No, you'll stay here and drink the dole when the humour is on you. You'll watch your sons going around with broken shoes and their arses hanging out of their trousers. Every house in the lane has electricity, and we're lucky if we have a candle. God above, if I had the fare, I'd be off to England myself, for I'm sure they need women in the factories. Dad says, a factory is no place for a woman. Mam says, sitting on your arse by the fire is no place for a man. I say to him, why can't you go to England, Dad, so we can have electricity and a wireless, and Mam can stand at the door and tell the world what we're having at dinner time? He says, don't you want to have your father here at home with you? I do. But you can come back at the end of the war, and we can all go to America. He sighs, achai, achai. All right. He'll go to England after Christmas, because America is in the war now, and the cause must be just. He'd never go if the Americans hadn't gone in. He tells me I'll have to be the man of the house, and he signs up with an agent to work in a factory in Coventry, which, everyone says, is the most bomb city in England. The agent says, there's plenty of work for willing men. You can work overtime till you drop, and if you save it up, mate, you'll be Rockefeller at the end of the war. We're up early to see Dad off at the railway station. Kathleen O'Connell at the shop knows Dad is off to England, and money will be flowing back, so she's happy to let Mam have credit for tea, milk, sugar, bread, butter, and an egg. An egg? Mam says, this egg is for your father. He needs the nourishment for the long journey before him. It's a hard-boiled egg, and Dad peels off the shell. He slices the egg five ways and gives each of us a bit to put on our bread. Mam says, don't be such a fool. Dad says, what would a man be doing with a whole egg to himself? Mam has tears in her eyelashes. She pulls her chair over to the fireplace. We all eat our bread and egg and watch her cry till she says, what are ye gawking at? And turns away to look into the ashes. Her bread and egg are still on the table, and I wonder if she has any plans for them. They look delicious, and I'm still hungry, but Dad gets up and brings them to her with the tea. She shakes her head, but he presses them on her, and she eats and drinks, snuffling and crying. He sits opposite her a while, silent, till she looks up at the clock and says, 'tis time to go. He puts on his cap and picks up his bag. Mam wraps Alfie in an old blanket, and we set off through the streets of Limerick. There are other families in the streets. The going-away fathers walk ahead. The mothers carry babies or push prams. A mother with the pram would say to other mothers, God above, missus, you must be fagged out carrying that child. Sure, why don't you stick him into the pram here and rest your poor arms? Prams might be packed with four or five babies squalling away, because the prams are old and the wheels bockety, and the babies are rocked till they get sick and throw up their goody. The men call to each other, Grand day, Mick. Lovely day for the journey, Joe. Tis indeed, Mick. Arra, we might as well have a pint before we go, Joe. We might as well, Mick. Might as well be drunk as the way we are, Joe. They laugh, and the women behind them are teary-eyed and red-nosed. In the pubs around the railway station, the men are packed in, drinking the money the agents gave them for travel food. They're having the last pint. The last drop of whiskey on Irish soil. For God knows it might be the last we'll ever have, Mick, the way the Jerries are bombing the bejesus out of England, and not a minute too soon, after what they did to us. And isn't it a tragic thing entirely, the way we have to go over there and save the arse of the ancient foe? The women stay outside the pubs talking. Ma'am tells Mrs. Meehan, "The first telegram money order I get, I'll be in the shop buying a big breakfast so that we can all have our own egg of a Sunday morning." I look at my brother Malachy. "Did you hear that? Our own egg of a Sunday morning? Oh, God! I already had plans for my egg. Tap it around the top, gently crack the shell, lift with a spoon, a dab of butter down into the yolk, salt, take my time, a dip of the spoon, scoop, more salt, more butter, into the mouth. Oh, God above, if heaven has a taste, it must be an egg with butter and salt. And after the egg, is there anything in the world lovelier than fresh, warm bread and a mug of sweet golden tea?" Some men are already too drunk to walk, and the English agents are paying sober men to drag them out of the pubs and throw them onto a great horse-drawn float to be hauled to the station and dumped into the train. The agents are desperate to get everyone out of the pubs. "Come on, men. Miss this train and you'll miss a good job. Come on, men. We have the Guinness in England. We have the Jameson. Now, men, please, men. You're drinking your food money and you'll get no more." The men tell the agents to kiss their Irish arses, that the agents are lucky they're alive, lucky they're not hanging from the nearest lamppost after what they did to Ireland. And the men sing, "On Mountjoy one Monday morning, high upon the gallows tree, Kevin Barry gave his young life for the cause of liberty." The train wails in the station, and the agents beg the women to get their men out of the pubs, and the men stumble out singing and crying and hugging their wives and children, and promising to send so much money, Limerick will be turned into another New York. The men climb the station steps, and the women and children call after them, "Kevin, love, mind yourself and don't be wearing damp shirts. Dry your socks, Michael, or the bunions will destroy you entirely. Paddy, go easy on the drink. Are you listening, Paddy?"
"Dad, Dad, don't go, Dad."
"Tommy, don't forget to send the money. The children are skin and bones. Peter, don't forget to be taking the medicine for your weak chest, God help us. Larry, mind them bloody bombs. Christy, don't be talking to them English women. They're full of diseases.
Jackie, come back. Sure we'll manage somehow. Don't go, Jackie, Jackie, oh Jesus, don't go."
Dad pats our heads. He tells us, remember our religious duties, but above all, obey our mother. He stands before her. She has the baby Alfie in her arms. She says, "Mind yourself." He drops the bag and puts his arms around her. They stay that way a moment till the baby yelps between them. He nods, picks up his bag, climbs the steps to the station, turns to wave, and he's gone. Back at home, Mam says, "I don't care. I know it sounds extravagant, but I'm going to light the fire and make more tea, for it isn't every day your father goes to England." We sit around the fire and drink our tea and cry, because we have no father, till Mam says, "Don't cry. Don't cry. Now that your father is gone to England, surely our troubles will be over. Surely." Mam and Bridie Hannon sit by the fire upstairs in Italy, smoking woodbines, drinking tea, and I sit on the stairs listening. We have a father in England, so that we can get all we want from Kathleen O'Connell's shop and pay when he starts sending the money in a fortnight. Mam tells Bridie she can't wait to get out of this bloody lane to a place with a decent lavatory that we don't have to share with half the world. We'll all have new boots and coats to keep off the rain, so we won't be coming home from school famished. We'll have eggs and rashers on Sunday for breakfast, and ham and cabbage and potatoes for dinner. We'll have electric light. Why shouldn't we? Weren't Frank and Malachy born to it in America, where everyone has it? All we have to do now is wait for 2 weeks till the telegram boy knocks at the door. Dad will have to settle into his job in England, buy work clothes, and get a place to stay. So the first money order won't be big, £3 or £3.10. But soon we'll be like other families in the lane, £5 a week, paying off debts, buying new clothes, putting something in the savings against the time we'll pack up and move to England entirely, and save there to go to America. Mam herself could get a job in an English factory making bombs or something, and God knows we wouldn't know ourselves with the money pouring in. She wouldn't be happy if we grew up with English accents, but better an English accent than an empty belly. Bridie says it doesn't matter what class of an accent an Irishman has, for he'll never forget what the English did to us for 800 long years. We know what Saturdays are in the lane. We know some families like the Downses across from us get their telegram early, because Mr. Downs is a steady man who knows how to have a pint or two on a Friday and go home to his bed. We know men like him run to the post office the minute they're paid, so their families won't know a minute of waiting or worry. Men like Mr. Downs send their sons RAF wings to wear on their coats. That's what we want, and that's what we told Dad before he left. Don't forget the RAF badges, Dad. We see the telegram boys on their bicycles swing into the lane. They're happy telegram boys because the tips they get in the lanes are bigger than anything they get in the grand streets and avenues where rich people would begrudge you the steam of their piss. The families that get the early telegrams have that contented look. They'll have all day Saturday to enjoy the money. They'll shop, they'll eat, they'll have all day to think about what they'll do that night. And that's almost as good as the thing itself, because Saturday night, when you have a few shillings in your pocket, is the most delicious night of the week. There are families don't get the telegram every week, and you know them by the anxious look. Mrs. Maher has waited at her door every Saturday for 2 months. My mother says she'd be ashamed of her life to wait at the door like that. All the children play in the lane and keep an eye out for the telegram boy. Hoi, telegram boy, do you have anything from Maher? And when he says no, they say, are you sure? And he'll say, course I'm sure. I know what I have in me feckin' pouch. Everyone knows the telegram boy stopped coming when the Angelus rings at 6, and darkness brings desperation to the women and children.
Telegram boy, will you look in your pouch again, please? Oh, God.
I did. I have nothing for ye.
Oh, God, please look. Our name is Maher. Will you look?
I know bloody well your name is Maher, and I looked. The children claw at him up on his bicycle, and he kicks at them.
Jesus, will you get away from me?
Once the Angelus rings at 6 in the evening, the day is over. The ones with the telegrams are having their supper with the electric light blazing away, and the ones that didn't get the telegram have to light candles and see if Kathleen O'Connell might let them have tea and bread till this time next week, when surely with the help of God and his blessed mother the telegram will come. Mr. Meehan, at the top of the lane, went to England with Dad, and when the telegram boy stops at Meehan's, we know we'll be next. Mam has her coat ready to go to the post office, but she won't leave the chair by the fire in Italy till she has the telegram in her hand. The telegram boy rides down the lane and swings over to Downs's. He hands them their telegram, takes the tip, and turns his bicycle around to head back up the lane. Malachy calls, "Telegram boy, do you have something from a court? Ours is coming today." The telegram boy shakes his head and rides away. Mam puffs in her woodbine.
Well, we have all day, though I'd like to do a bit of shopping early before the best hams are gone at Barry the Butcher.
She can't leave the fire, and we can't leave the lane for fear the telegram boy might come and find no one at home. Then we'd have to wait till Monday to cash the money order, and that would destroy the weekend entirely. We'd have to watch the Meehans and everyone else parading around in their new clothes and staggering home with eggs and potatoes and sausages for Sunday and sailing off to the films on Saturday night. No, we can't move an inch till that telegram boy comes. Mam says, don't be too worried between noon and two because so many telegram boys go for their dinner and there will surely be a big rush between two and the Angelus. We don't have a thing to worry about till six. We stop every telegram boy. We tell them our name is McCourt, that this is our first telegram. It should be £3 or more. They might have forgotten to put our name in it, or our address. Is he sure? Is he sure? One boy tells us he'll inquire at the post office. He says he knows what 'tis like to wait for the telegram because his own father is a drunken old shit over in England that never sent a penny. Mam hears him inside and tells us you should never talk about your father like that. The same telegram boy comes back just before the Angelus at six and tells us he asked Mrs. O'Connell at the post office if they had anything from McCourt all day and they didn't. Mam turns towards the dead ashes in the fire and sucks at the last bit of goodness in the woodbine butt, caught between the brown thumb and the burnt middle finger. Michael, who's only five and won't understand anything till he's 11 like me, wants to know if we're having fish and chips tonight because he's hungry. Mam says, next week, love. And he goes back out to play in the lane. You don't know what to do with yourself when the first telegram doesn't come. You can't stay out in the lane playing with your brothers all night because everyone else has gone in and you'd be ashamed to stay out in the lane to be tormented with smells of sausages and rashers and fried bread. You don't want to look at electric light coming through the windows after dark and you don't want to hear the news from the BBC or radio and from other people's wirelesses. Mrs. Maher and her children are gone in and there's only the dim light of a candle from their kitchen. They're ashamed too. They stay inside on Saturday nights, and they don't even go to Mass on Sunday mornings. Bridie Hannon told Mam that Mrs. Maher is in a constant state of shame over the rags they wear, and so desperate she goes down to the dispensary for the public assistance. Mam says that's the worst thing that could happen to any family. It's worse than going on the dole. It's worse than going to the St. Vincent de Paul Society. It's worse than begging on the streets with the tinkers and the knackers. It's the last thing you do to keep yourself out of the poorhouse and the children from the orphanage. There's a sore at the top of my nose between my eyebrows, grey and red, and itching. Grandma says, don't touch that sore and don't put water near it or it'll spread. If you broke your arm, she'd say, don't touch that with water, it'll spread. The sore spreads into my eyes anyway, and now they're red and yellow from the stuff that oozes and makes them stick in the morning. They stick so hard, I have to force my eyelids open with my fingers, and Mam has to scrub off that yellow stuff with a damp rag and boric powder. The eyelashes fall off, and every bit of dust in Limerick blows into my eyes in windy days. Grandma tells me I have naked eyes, and she says 'tis my own fault. All that eye trouble comes from sitting up there at the top of the lane under the light pole in all kinds of weather with my nose stuck in books. And the same thing will happen to Malachy if he doesn't give over with the reading. You can see little Michael is getting just as bad, sticking his nose in books, when he should be out playing like a healthy child. Books, 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 says Grandma. Ye will ruin your eyes entirely. She's having tea with Mam, and I hear her whisper, the thing to do is to give him St. Anthony's spit. What's that, says Mam? Your fasting spit in the morning. Go to him before he wakes and spit on his eye, for the spit of a fasting mother has powerful cures in it. But I'm always awake before, ma'am. I force my eyes open long before she stirs. I can hear her coming across the floor. And when she stands over me for the spit, I open my eyes. God, she says, your eyes are open. I think they're getting better. That's good. And she goes back to bed. The eyes don't heal, and she takes me to the dispensary where the poor people see doctors and get their medicines. It's the place to apply for public assistance when a father is dead or disappeared, and there's no dole money, no wages. There are benches along the walls by the doctor's offices. The benches are always packed with people talking about their ailments. Old men and women sit and groan, and babies scream, and mothers say, "Hush, love, hush." There's a height platform in the middle of the dispensary, with a counter circling it, chest high. When you want anything, you stand in a queue before that platform to see Mr. Coffey or Mr. Kane. The women in the queue are like the women at the St. Vincent de Paul Society. They wear shawls, and they're respectful to Mr. Coffey and Mr. Kane, because if they're not, they might be told, go away and come back next week when it's this minute you need the public assistance or a docket to see the doctor. Mr. Coffey and Mr. Kane love to have a good laugh with the women. They'll decide if you're desperate enough for the public assistance or if you're sick enough to see a doctor. You have to tell them in front of everyone what's wrong with you, and they often have a good laugh with that. They'll say, "And what is it you want, Mrs. O'Shea? A docket for the doctor, is it? And what is your trouble, Mrs. O'Shea? A pain, is it? A touch of the wind, maybe? Or maybe too much cabbage? Oh, the cabbage will do it right enough." They laugh, and Mrs. O'Shea laughs, and all the women laugh, and say Mr. Coffey and Mr. Kane are funny men. They'd give Laurel and Hardy a run for their money. Mr. Coffey says, "Now, woman, what's your name?"
"Angela McCourt, sir."
"And what's up with you?"
"'Tis my son, sir. He has two bad eyes."
"Oh, by God, he does, woman. They're desperate-looking eyes altogether. They look like two rising suns. The Japs could use him on their flag. Ha, ha, ha. Did he pour acid on his face, or what?"
"'Tis some class of infection, sir. He had the typhoid last year, and then this came."
"All right, all right. We don't need the life story. Here's your docket to Dr. Troy."
Two long benches are filled with patients for Dr. Troy. Ma'am sits next to a woman who has a big sore on her nose that won't go away.
"I tried everything, missus. Every known cure on God's lovely earth. I'm 83 years of age, and I'd like to go to my grave healthy. Is it too much to ask that I meet my Redeemer with a healthy nose? And what's up with yourself, missus?"
"My son. The eyes."
"Ah, God bless us and save us. Look at them eyes. They're the sorest two eyes I ever seen in me life. I never seen that colour red before."
"'Tis an infection, missus."
"Sure there's a cure for that. You need the call."
"What's that now?"
"Babies are born with this thing on their heads, a class of a hood, rare and magical. Get a call and put that on his head any day that has a three in it. Make him hold his breath for 3 minutes, even if you have to clap your hand over his face. Sprinkle him with holy water 3 times head to toenail, and his two eyes will shine in the dawn."
"And where would I get a call?"
"Don't all the midwives have calls, missus? What's a midwife without a call? It cures all classes of disease and keeps off more."
Ma'am says she'll talk to Nurse O'Halloran and see if she has a spare call. Dr. Troy looks at my eyes. "Into the hospital with this boy at once. Take him to the eye ward at the city home. Here's the docket to get him in."
"What does he have, doctor?"
"The worst case of conjunctivitis I've ever seen in my life, and something else in there I can't make out. He needs the eye man."
"How long will he be in, doctor?"
"Only God knows that. I should have seen this child weeks ago."
There are 20 beds in the ward, and there are men and boys with bandages around their heads, black patches on their eyes, thick glasses. Some walk around tapping at beds with sticks,
A man cries all the time that he'll never see again. He's too young. His children are babies. He'll never see them again. Jesus Christ, oh Jesus Christ. And the nuns are shocked at the way he takes the name of the Lord in vain.
Stop that, Morris. Stop the blasphemy. You have your health. You're alive. We all have our problems. Offer it up and think of the sufferings of our Lord on the cross, the crown of thorns, the nails in his poor hands and feet, the wound in his side.
Morris says, "Oh, Jesus, look down and have pity on me."
Sister Bernadette warns him, if he doesn't mind his language, they'll put him in a ward alone, and he says, "Heavenly God!" And that isn't as bad as Jesus Christ, so she's satisfied. In the morning, I have to go downstairs for drops. The nurse says,
"Sit in this high chair, and here's a nice sweet."
The doctor has a bottle with brown stuff in it. He tells me, "Put my head back."
"That's right. Now open up. Open your eyes."
And he pours the stuff into my right eye, and it's a flame going through my skull. The nurse says,
"Open the other eye. Come on, be a good boy."
And she has to force the eyelids open so the doctor can set fire to the other side of my skull. She wipes my cheeks and tells me run along upstairs, but I can barely see, and I want to stick my face into an icy stream. The doctor says,
"Run along. Be a man. Be a good trooper."
The whole world is brown and blurry on the stairs. The other patients are sitting by their beds with dinner trays, and mine is there too, but I don't want it with the way my skull is raging. I sit by my bed, and a boy across the way says,
"Hi, don't you want your dinner? I'll take it."
And he comes for it. I try to lie in the bed, but a nurse says,
"Now, now, no lying on the bed in the middle of the day. Your case isn't that serious."
I have to sit with my eyes closed and everything going brown and black, black and brown, and I'm sure I must be having a dream because,
Lord God above, is that the little fellow with the typhoid? Little Frankie, the moon was a ghostly galleon tossed upon cloudy seas. Is that yourself, Frankie? For wasn't I promoted out of the fever hospital, thank God, where there's every class of disease? And you never know what germs you might be bringing home to the wife in your clothes. And what's up with you, Frankie? And the two eyes in your head all gone brown?
I have an infection, Seamus.
Yeah, you'll be over that before you're married, Frankie. The eyes need exercise. The blink is great value for the eyes. I had an uncle with bad eyes, and the blink saved him. He sat an hour every day and blinked, and it stood to him in the end. Wound up with powerful eyes, so he did.
I want to ask him more about the blink of the powerful eyes, but he says,
"Now, do you remember the poem, Frankie? The lovely poem of Patricia?"
He stands in the aisle between the beds with his mop and his bucket and says the highwayman poem, and all the patients stop their moaning, and the nuns and nurses stand and listen, and on goes Seamus, till he comes to the end, and everyone goes mad clapping and cheering him, and he tells the world he loves that poem, he'll have it in his head forever, no matter where he goes. And if it wasn't for Frankie McCourt and his typhoid there, and poor Patricia Madigan with the diphtheria that's gone, God rest her, he'd never know the poem, and there I am, famous in the eye ward of the City Home Hospital, and all because of Seamus. Mam can't come to visit every day. It's a long way out. She doesn't always have the money for the bus, and the walk is hard in her corns. She thinks my eyes look better, though you can't tell with all that brown stuff, which looks and smells like iodine, and if it's anything like iodine, it must burn. Still, they say the bitterer the medicine, the quicker the cure. She gets permission to take me for a walk around the grounds when the weather clears. And there's a strange sight. Mr. Timoney standing against the wall where the old people are, with his eyes raised to the sky. I want to talk to him, and I have to ask, ma'am, because you never know what's right or wrong in a hospital. Mr. Timoney?
Who is it? Who do we have?
Frank McCourt, sir.
Francis. Ah, Francis.
Ma'am says,
I'm his mother, Mr. Timoney.
Well then,
The two of ye are blessed. I have neither kith nor kin nor Makushla, my dog. And what are you doing in this place, Francis?
I have an infection in my eyes.
Ah, Jesus, Francis, not the eyes, not the eyes. Mother of Christ, you're too young for that.
Mr. Timoney, would you like me to read to you?
With them eyes, Francis, ah, no, son, save the eyes. I'm beyond reading. In my head I have everything I need. I was smart enough to put things in my head in my youth, and now I have a library in my head. The English shot my wife. The Irish put down my poor, innocent Makushla. Isn't it a joke of a world?
Ma'am says, terrible world, but God is good.
Indeed, missus, God made the world. It's a terrible world, but God is good. Goodbye, Francis. Rest your eyes, and then read till they fall out of your head. We had good times with old Jonathan Swift, didn't we, Francis?
We did, Mr. Timoney.
Ma'am takes me back to the eye ward. She tells me,
don't be crying over Mr. Timoney. He's not even your father. Besides, you'll be ruining your eyes.
Seamus comes to the ward 3 times a week and brings new poems in his head. He says,
you made Patricia sad, Frankie, when you didn't like the one about the owl and the pussycat.
I'm sorry, Seamus.
I have it in my head, Frankie, and I'll say it for you if you don't say 'tis foolish.
I won't, Seamus.
He says the poem, and everyone in the ward loves it. They want the words, and he says it 3 more times till the whole ward is saying. The owl and the pussycat went to sea in a beautiful pea-green boat. They took some honey and plenty of money wrapped up in a 5-pound note. The owl looked up to the stars above and sang to a small guitar. Oh, lovely pussy, oh, pussy, my love, what a beautiful pussy you are, you are. You are what a beautiful pussy you are.
They say it along with Seamus now, and when it's finished they cheer and clap and Seamus laughs, delighted with himself. When he's gone with his mop and bucket, you can hear them at all hours of the day and night.
Oh, lovely pussy, oh, pussy, my love, what a beautiful pussy you are. You are, you are, what a beautiful pussy you are.
Then Seamus comes with no mop and no bucket. And I'm afraid he's sacked over the poetry, but he's smiling and telling me he's off to England to work in a factory and earn decent wages for a change. He'll work for 2 months and bring the wife over, and God might be pleased to send them children, for he has to do something with all the poems in his head. And what better than saying them to small ones in memory of that sweet Patricia Madigan, dead of the diphtheria?
Goodbye, Francis. If I had the right fist, I'd write to you. But I'll get the wife to write when she comes over. I might even learn to read and write myself so that the child that comes won't have a fool for a father. I want to cry, but you can't cry in the eye ward with brown stuff in your eyes and nurses saying, what's this, what's this, be a man, and nuns going on, offer it up, think of the sufferings of our Lord on the cross, the crown of thorns, the lance in the side, the hands and feet torn to bits with nails. I'm a month in the hospital, and the doctor says I can go home, even if there's still a bit of infection, but if I keep the eyes clean with soap and clean towels, and build up my health with nourishing food, plenty of beef and eggs, I'll have a pair of sparkling eyes in no time. Ha ha! Mr. Downs across the way comes back from England for his mother's funeral. He tells Mrs. Downs about my father. She tells Bridie Hannon, and Bridie tells my mother. Mr. Downs says, that Malachy McCourt has gone pure mad with the drink, that he squanders his wages in pubs all over Coventry, that he sings Irish rebel songs, which the English don't mind, because they're used to the way the Irish carry on about the hundreds of years of suffering, but they won't put up with any man that stands up in a pub and insults the King and Queen of England, their 2 lovely daughters, and the Queen Mother herself. Insulting the Queen Mother is going beyond the beyonds. What did she ever do to anyone, that poor old lady? Time after time, Maliki drinks away his rent money and winds up sleeping in parks when the landlord throws him out. He's a regular disgrace, so he is, and Mr. Downs is glad McCourt is not a Limerick man, bringing shame to this ancient city. The magistrates in Coventry are losing their patience, and if Maliki McCourt doesn't stop the bloody nonsense, he'll be kicked out of the country entirely. Mam tells Bridie she doesn't know what she's going to do with these stories from England. She never felt so desperate in her life. She can see Kathleen O'Connell doesn't want to give any more credit at the shop, and her own mother barks at her if she asks for the loan of a shilling, and the St. Vincent de Paul Society want to know when she'll stop asking for charity, especially with a husband in England. She's ashamed of the way we look, with the dirty old torn shirts, raggedy gansies, broken shoes, holes in our stockings. She lies awake at night, thinking the most merciful thing of all would be to put the four boys in an orphanage, so that she could go to England herself and find some type of work, where she could bring us all over in a year for the better life. There might be bombs, but she'd prefer bombs any time to the shame of begging from this one and that one. No, no matter what, she can't bear the thought of putting us in the orphanage. That might be all right if you had the likes of Boys Town in America with a nice priest like Spencer Tracy, but you could never trust the Christian Brothers out in Glynn, who get their exercise beating boys and starving the life out of them. Mam says there's nothing left but the dispensary and the public assistance, the relief, and she's ashamed of her life to go and ask for it. It means you're at the end of your rope, and maybe one level above tinkers, knackers, and street beggars in general. It means you have to crawl before Mr. Coffey and Mr. Kane, and thank God the dispensary is at the other end of Limerick, so that people in our lane won't know we're getting the relief. She knows from other women it's wise to be there early in the morning, where Mr. Coffey and Mr. Kane might be in a good mood. If you go late in the morning, they're liable to be cranky after seeing hundreds of men, women and children sick and asking for help. She'll take us with her to prove she has four children to feed. She gets us up early and tells us for once in our lives, don't wash our faces, don't comb our hair, dress in any old rag. She tells me, give my sore eyes a good rub and make them as red as I can, for the worse you look at the dispensary, the more pity you'll get, and the better your chances of getting the public assistance. She complains that Maliki, Michael and Alfie look too healthy, and you'd wonder why on this day of days they couldn't have their usual scabby knees or the odd cut, bruise or black eye. If we meet anyone in the lane or the streets of Limerick, we are not to tell them where we're going. She feels ashamed enough without telling the whole world, and wait till her own mother hears. There's a queue already outside the dispensary. There are women like Mam with children in their arms, babies like Alfie, and children playing on the pavement. The women comfort the babies against the cold and scream at the ones playing in case they run into the street and get hit by a motor car or a bicycle. There are old men and women huddled against the wall, talking to themselves, or not talking at all. Mam warns us not to wander from her, and we wait half an hour for the big door to open. A man tells us, move inside in proper order and queue up before the platform, that Mr. Coffey and Mr. Ken will be there in a minute when they finish their tea in the room beyond. A woman complains her children are freezing with the cold, and couldn't Coffey and Ken bloody well hurry up with their tea? The man says she's a troublemaker, but he won't take her name this time with the cold that's in the morning. But if there's another word, she'll be a sorry woman. Mr. Coffey and Mr. Kane get up on the platform and pay no attention to the people. Mr. Kane puts on his glasses, takes them off, polishes them, puts them on, looks at the ceiling. Mr. Coffey reads papers, writes something, passes papers to Mr. Kane. They whisper to each other. They take their time. They don't look at us.
Then Mr. Kane calls the first old man to the platform.
What's your name?
Timothy Cray, sir.
Craig, huh? A fine old Limerick name you have there.
I do, sir. Indeed, I do.
And what do you want, Cray?
Ah, sure, I do be having them pains in me stomach again, and I'd like to see Dr. Feely.
Well now, Cray, are you sure it's not the pints of porter that are going against your stomach?
Ah, no, indeed, sir. Surely I hardly touch the pint at all with the pains. My wife is home in the bed and I have to take care of her too.
There's great laziness in the world, Cray.
And Mr. Kane says to the people on the queue,
did you hear that, ladies? Great laziness, isn't there?
And the women say,
oh, there is indeed, Mr. Kane, great laziness.
Mr. Cray gets his docket to see the doctor. The queue moves ahead, and Mr. Kane is ready for ma'am.
The public assistance, is that what you want, woman? The relief?
Tis, Mr. Kane.
And where's your husband?
Oh, he's in England, but
England, is it? And where is the Weekly Telegram, the big £5?
He didn't send us a penny in months, Mr. Kane.
Is that a fact? Well, we know why, don't we? We know what the men of Ireland are up to in England. We know there's the occasional Limerick man seen trotting around with a Piccadilly tart, don't we?
He looks out at the people on the queue, and they know they're supposed to say,
we do, Mr. Kane.
And they know they're supposed to smile and laugh, or things will go hard with them when they reach the platform. They know he might turn them over to Mr. Coffey, and he's notorious for saying no to everything. Ma'am tells Mr. Kane that Dad is in Coventry and nowhere near Piccadilly. And Mr. Kane takes off his glasses and stares at her.
What's this? Are we having a little contradiction here?
Oh, no, Mr. Kane. God, no.
I want you to know, woman, that it is the policy here to give no relief to women with husbands in England. I want you to know you're taking the bread from the mouths of more deserving people who stayed in this country to do their bit.
Oh, yes, Mr. Kane.
And what's your name?
McCourt, sir.
That's not a Limerick name. Where did you get a name like that?
My husband, sir, he's from the north.
He's from the north? And he leaves you here to get the relief from the Irish Free State? Is this what we fought for, is it?
I don't know, sir.
Why don't you go up to Belfast to see what the Orange men will do for you, eh?
I don't know, sir.
You don't know? Of course you don't know. There's great ignorance in the world.
He looks out at the people.
I said, there's great ignorance in the world.
And the people nod their heads and agree, there's great ignorance in the world. He whispers to Mr. Coffey, and they look at ma'am, they look at us. He tells ma'am at last that she can have the public assistance, but if she gets a single penny from her husband, she's to drop all claims and give the money back to the dispensary. She promises she will. And we leave. We follow her to Kathleen O'Connell's shop to get tea and bread and a few sods of turf for the fire. We climb the stairs to Italy and get the fire going, and it's cosy when we have our tea. We're all very quiet, even the baby Alfie, because we know what Mr. Kane did to our mother. It's cold and wet down in Ireland, but we're up in Italy. Ma'am says we should bring the poor Pope up to hang on the wall opposite the window. After all, he's a friend of the working man, he's Italian, and they're a warm-weather people. Ma'am sits by the fire shivering, and we know something is wrong when she makes no move for a cigarette. She says she feels a cold coming, and she'd love to have a tarty drink, a lemonade. But there's no money in the house, not even for bread in the morning. She drinks tea and goes to bed. The bed creaks all night with her twistings and turnings, and she keeps us awake with her moaning for water.
In the morning, she stays in bed, still shivering, and we keep quiet. If she sleeps long enough, Maliki and I will be too late for school. Hours pass, and still she makes no move. And when I know it's well past school time, I start the fire for the kettle. She stirs and calls for lemonade, but I give her a jam jar of water. I ask her if she'd like some tea, and she acts like a woman gone deaf. She looks flushed, and it's odd she doesn't even mention cigarettes. We sit quietly by the fire, Maliki, Michael, Alfie, myself. We drink our tea while Alfie chews the last bit of bread covered with sugar. He makes us laugh the way he smears the sugar all over his face and grins at us with his fat, sticky cheeks. But we can't laugh too much or Mam will jump out of the bed and order Maliki and me off to school, where we'll be killed for being late. We don't laugh long. There's no more bread and we're hungry, the four of us. We can get no more credit at O'Connell's shop. We can't go near Grandma either. She yells at us all the time because Dad is from the north and he never sends money home from England where he's working in a munitions factory. Grandma says we could starve to death for all he cares. That would teach Mam a lesson for marrying a man from the north with sallow skin, an odd manner, and a look of the Presbyterian about him. Still, I'll have to try Kathleen O'Connell once more. I'll tell her my mother is sick above in the bed, my brothers are starving, and we'll all be dead for the want of bread. I put on my shoes and run quickly through the streets of Limerick to keep myself warm against the February frost. You can look in people's windows and see how cozy it is in their kitchens with their fires glowing or ranges black and hot. Everything bright in the electric light. Cups and saucers on the table with plates of sliced bread, pounds of butter, jars of jam, smells of fried eggs and rashers coming through the windows, enough to make the water run in your mouth, and family sitting there digging in, all smiling, the mother crisp and clean in her apron, everyone washed, and the Sacred Heart of Jesus looking down at them from the wall, suffering and sad, but still happy with all that food and light and good Catholics at their breakfast. I tried to find music in my own head, but all I could find is my mother moaning for lemonade. Lemonade! There's a van pulling away from South's pub, leaving crates of beer and lemonade outside, and there isn't a soul in the street. In a second I have two bottles of lemonade up under my jersey, and I saunter away trying to look innocent. There's a bread van outside Kathleen O'Connell's shop. The back door is open on shelves of steaming, newly baked bread. The van driver is inside the shop having tea in a bun with Kathleen, and it's no trouble for me to help myself to a loaf of bread. It's wrong to steal from Kathleen with the way she's always good to us, but if I go in and ask her for bread, she'll be annoyed and tell me I'm ruining her morning cup of tea, which she'd like to have in peace, ease and comfort, thank you. It's easier to stick the bread up under my jersey with the lemonade and promise to tell everything in confession. My brothers are back in bed, playing games under the overcoats, but they jump when they see the bread. We tear at the loaf because we're too hungry to slice it, and we make tea from this morning's leaves. When my mother stirs, Maliki holds the lemonade bottle to her lips, and she gasps till she finishes it. If she likes it that much, I'll have to find more lemonade. We put the last of the coal on the fire and sit around telling stories, which we make up the way Dad did. I tell my brothers about my adventures with the lemonade and bread. And I make up stories about how I was chased by pub owners and shopkeepers, and how I ran into St. Joseph's Church where no one can follow you if you're a criminal, not even if you killed your own mother. Maliki and Michael look shocked over the way I got the bread and lemonade, but then Maliki says it was only what Robin Hood would have done, rob the rich and give to the poor. Michael says I'm an outlaw, and if they catch me, they'll hang me from the highest tree in the People's Park, the way outlaws are hanged in films at the Lyric Cinema. Maliki says I should make sure I'm in a state of grace because it might be hard to find the priest to come to my hanging. I tell him a priest would have to come to the hanging. That's what priests are for.
Roddy McCauley had a priest, and so did Kevin Barry. Maliki says there were no priests at the hanging of Roddy McCauley and Kevin Barry, because they're not mentioned in the songs, and he starts singing the songs to prove it till my mother groans in the bed and says, "Shut up!" Alfie the baby is asleep on the floor by the fire. We put him into the bed with Mam so that he'll be warm enough, though we don't want him to catch her disease and die. If she wakes up and finds him dead in the bed beside her, there would be no end to the lamentations, and she'd blame me on top of it. The three of us get back into our own bed, huddling under the overcoats and trying not to roll into the hole in the mattress. It's pleasant there till Michael starts to worry over Alfie getting Mam's disease and me getting hanged for an outlaw. He says it isn't fair, because that would leave him with only one brother, and everyone in the world has brothers galore. He falls asleep from the worry, and soon Maliki drifts off, and I lie there thinking of jam. Wouldn't it be lovely to have another loaf of bread and a jar of strawberry jam, or any kind of jam? I can't remember ever seeing a jam van making a delivery, and I wouldn't want to be like Jesse James blasting my way into a shop demanding jam. That would surely lead to a hanging. There's a cold sun coming through the window, and I'm sure it must be warmer outside. And would my brothers be surprised if they woke and found me there with more bread and jam? They'd gobble everything and then go on about my sins and a hanging. Mam is still asleep, though her face is red, and there's a strangling sound when she snores. I have to be careful going through the street because it's a school day, and if Gar Dennehy sees me, he'll drag me off to school, and Mr. O'Halloran will knock me all over the classroom. The guard is in charge of school attendance, and he loves chasing you on his bicycle and dragging you off to school by the ear. There's a box sitting outside the door of one of the big houses on Barrington Street. I pretend to knock on the door so that I can see what's in the box. A bottle of milk, loaf of bread, cheese, tomatoes, and, oh God, a jar of marmalade. I can't shove all that under my jersey. Oh God! Should I take the whole box? The people passing by me pay no attention. I might as well take the whole box. My mother would say you might as well be hung for a sheep as a lamb. I lift the box and try to look like a messenger boy making a delivery. And no one says a word. Maliki and Michael are beside themselves when they see what's in the box, and they're soon gobbling thick cuts of bread slathered with golden marmalade. Alfie has the marmalade all over his face and hair, and a good bit on his legs and belly. We wash down the food with cold tea because we have no fire to heat it. Mam mumbles again for lemonade, and I give her half the second bottle to keep her quiet. She calls for more, and I mix it with water to stretch it because I can't be spending my life running around lifting lemonade from pubs. We're having a fine time of it till Mam begins to rave in the bed about her lovely little daughter taken from her and her twin boys gone before they were three, and why couldn't God take the rich for a change, and is there any lemonade in the house? Michael wants to know if Mam will die, and Maliki tells him, "You can't die till the priest comes." Then Michael wonders if we'll ever have a fire and hot tea again, because he's freezing in the bed, even with the overcoats left over from olden times. Maliki says we should go from house to house asking for turf and coal and wood, and we could use Alfie's pram to carry the load. We should take Alfie with us because he's small and he smiles, and people would see him and feel sorry for him and us. We try to wash all the dirt and lint and feathers and sticky marmalade, but when we touch him with water, he howls. Michael says he'll only get dirty again in the pram, so what's the use of washing him? Michael is small, but he's always saying remarkable things like that. We push the pram out to the rich avenues and roads, but when we knock on the doors, the maids tell us, go away, or they'll call the proper authorities, and it's a disgrace to be dragging a baby around in a wreck of a pram that that smells to the heavens, a filthy contraption that you wouldn't use to haul a pig to the slaughterhouse. And this is a Catholic country where babies should be cherished and kept alive to hand down the faith from generation to generation. Malachy tells one maid to kiss his arse, and she gives him such a clout the tears leap to his eyes, and he says he'll never in his life ask the rich for anything again. He says there's no use asking any more, that we should go around to the backs of the houses and climb over the walls and take what we want. Michael can ring the front doorbells to keep the maids busy, and Malachy and I can throw coal and turf over the walls and fill the pram all around Alfie. We collect that way from three houses, but then Malachy throws a piece of coal over a wall and hits Alfie, and he starts screaming, and we have to run, forgetting Michael, still ringing doorbells and getting abuse from maids. Malachy says we should take the pram home first and then go back for Michael. We can't stop now with Alfie bawling and people giving us dirty looks and telling us we're a disgrace to our mother and Ireland in general. When we're back home, it takes a while to dig Alfie out from under the load of coal and turf, and he won't stop screaming till I give him bread and marmalade. I'm afraid Mam will leap from her bed, but she only mumbles on about Dad and drink and baby's dead. Malachy is back with Michael, with stories of his adventures ringing doorbells. One rich woman answered the door herself and invited him into the kitchen for cake and milk and bread and jam. She asked him all about his family, and he told her his father had a big job in England, but his mother is in the bed with a desperate disease and calling for lemonade morning, noon and night. The rich woman wanted to know who was taking care of us, and Michael bragged we were taking care of ourselves, that there was no shortage of bread and marmalade. The rich woman wrote down Michael's name and address and told him be a good boy and go home to his brothers and his mother in the bed. Malachy barks at Michael for being such a fool as to tell a rich woman anything. She'll go now and tell on us, and before we know it we'll have the priest of the world banging on the door and disturbing us. There's the banging on the door already, but it isn't the priest, it's Gard Dennehy. He calls up, "Hello, hello, is anybody home? Are you there, Mrs. McCourt?" Michael knocks on the window and waves at the guard. I give him a good kick for himself, and Malachy thumps him on the head and he yells, "I'll tell the guard, I'll tell the guard, they're killing me, guard, they're thumping and kicking." He won't shut up, and Gard Dennehy shouts at us to open the door. I call out the window and tell him I can't open the door because my mother is in bed with a terrible disease. "Where's your father?" "He's in England." "Well, I'm coming in to talk to your mother."
"You can't, you can't. She has the disease. We all have the disease. It might be the typhoid. It might be the galloping consumption. We're getting spots already. The baby has a lump. It could kill."
He pushes in the door and climbs the stairs to Italy, just as Alfie crawls out from under the bed, covered with marmalade and dirt. He looks at him and my mother and us, takes off his cap and scratches his head. He says, "Jesus, Mary and Joseph, this is a desperate situation. How did your mother get sick like that?" I tell him he shouldn't go near her. And when Malachy says we might not be able to go to school for ages, the guard says we'll go to school no matter what, that we're on the earth to go to school the way he's on the earth to make sure we go to school. He wants to know if we have any relations, and he sends me off to tell Grandma and Aunt Aggie to come to our house. They scream at me and tell me I'm filthy. I try to explain that Mam has the disease, and I'm worn out trying to make ends meet, keeping the home fires burning, getting lemonade from Mam and bread from my brothers. There's no use telling them about the marmalade, for they'll only scream again. There's no use telling them about the nastiness of rich people and their maids. They push me all the way back to the lane, barking at me and disgracing me on the streets of Limerick. Gard Dennehy is still scratching his poll. He says, "Look at this, a disgrace. You wouldn't see the likes of this in Bombay or the Bowery of New York itself." Grandma is wailing at my mother.
Mother of God, Angela, what's up with you in the bed? What did they do to you?
My mother runs her tongue over her dry lips and gasps for more lemonade.
She wants lemonade,
says Michael,
and we